Well, today's message has been long in preparation, something I've been wanting to do for a long time. However, I think I'm going to have to talk with the people who assign topics because I thought this was going to be easy. Turns out it's not easy at all when we realize what it's really teaching us regarding God's plan for humanity. It involves us. We're in it, up to our chin, I guess we could say. What God is doing. It's interesting that as I was signing off on the computer this morning after printing out my notes, something popped up and I thought, well, maybe I'll listen to this. It just didn't seem relevant, but it turns out it was. It was a neurologist, and he was explaining the value of doing puzzles as compared to watching TV or something else. Doing puzzles does something to your neurological makeup of your thinking, your brain. Well, the message today is about a puzzle. The 12th chapter of Revelation is very puzzling because it raises more questions than it answers, or at least that's what it seems to be. He was pointing out that when you do a puzzle, you're forced to use parts of your brains, and parts of your brains take that information back to a convergence point in two different manners, in two different modes. When you look at a puzzle piece, it's got color, and the color will help you identify where it belongs in the picture. One part of your brain analyzes that. But the puzzle piece also has a shape. So no matter where you think it belongs, the shape may say otherwise. So you have to analyze the shape as well as the color in order to get the picture that you're supposed to be. Well, in Revelation 12, there's a similar construction. Two things that as we go through this, I want you to keep in the back of your minds. Consider the time frame. The narrative there is presenting to us a time frame, and that seems to be fading in and out in different eras. Also consider the identities of the players being described. Time frame and identities. Those are the two things to keep in mind as we go through this passage. I'm convinced that the 12th chapter of Revelation is a training tool to help us understand the rest of the book. Once we understand how to think, how to analyze the information that's presented to us, this chapter gives us an exercise in advance so that as we go through the more complicated stuff, we can get the gist of what he's saying in a more important way. So consider the time frame and consider the identities. What does it do for us to know what God is presenting in this particular book, which is very different from the rest of the books of the Bible, perhaps with the exception of the book of Daniel. Revelation 12 gives us a broad overview of the entire spectrum of history, particularly as it relates to the people of God. What is happening? What is going on? Why are things the way they are? Here we get answers that we wouldn't ordinarily understand. The book is broken up into what I've identified as 10 different scenarios, 10 different narratives. The first part describes the woman and her mission. Who is the woman? Do we know? Do we have an answer that satisfies the question? The second portion describes the dragon, the great red dragon, who is the adversary of the woman. The third segment reveals that there is a contingent of adversarial agents that are in cahoots with the dragon. The fourth segment introduces the man-child and his destiny. The fifth segment explains the need for protection from this evil adversary. The sixth reveals a war, or should we say wars, in heaven related to this effort to bring forth the man-child. The seventh describes the millennial environment. The eighth section talks about Satan's release upon the righteous. When is that? The ninth talks about the woman being provided sanctuary for a period of time. And then 10, and this is perhaps the most relevant of all, describes a great flood that emits out of the mouth of the dragon that is swallowed up by the earth. What does that mean? What does that picture? It's very, very interesting to understand that there is an underlying message of all this that ought to make us aware of what God is doing with us. We're a part of this. We're in this picture. That's the first thing we need to understand. This particular chapter is very comparable to what we would call computer-generated animation in the modern sense. It's creating a mind picture. As you read through it, your mind will create a picture, and may not necessarily be what picture is intended that we receive, but it creates a mind picture, a scene from what it's presenting to us. What do we make of that? Does it help us understand what's happening throughout history and to us in this time frame? I'm confident that it does. It's something that tells us a great deal about God's overall plan, particularly as it relates to the identities of the players in this picture. Who are they? Some are obvious, some may not. Let's start with the woman. And that we'll find in the first few verses of the chapter. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven. This is verse 1. A woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. Who is that woman? Now, when you think of this in the time context, it's very difficult to assign an identity to that woman. It's not the 12 tribes of physical Israel. That might be an early conclusion, but when we look at it, number one, the physical nation of Israel didn't bring forth this man-child. at the time that that man-child, if we're talking about Christ's physical birth, the segment of Israel, at least, that was in the proximity to this event, wanted to kill him. So how can we say that was the entity that brought him forth? You see, we got a question right off the bat. Who is that woman? Well, one thing about that woman, there's a reference to what we might assume or deduce is her. This found in Galatians 4:26, where it calls her the mother of us all. Does that help us do some identifying here as to who exactly she is? Clothed with the sun. We certainly can't say that of apostate physical Israel. Clothed with the sun. Who is clothed with the sun? The sun, of course, represents the nature of Christ. And it has the moon under her feet. That being a foundation that reflects the light of the sun. That the moon, I think, represents a shadow religious system that has been the foundation for what was to come later. Can we make that deduction? That the moon is referring to the old religious system that is superseded by the sun, the full-blown sun. Would that make any sense? Would that help us identify who is this woman? And upon her head, a crown of 12 stars. Now that is an extremely high commendation of any entity. That is how Christ pictures her. That certainly is not physical Israel, either ancient or modern. 12 stars upon her head. I pose to you that it's the true church. That's how Christ sees the church, the ecclesia, those that he has called out, those that he is using throughout history. That is how she appears to him. And that woman is going to bring forth the man-child. This isn't talking about Christ's physical birth. This is talking about bringing forth in some other manner. Bringing forth in the sense of proclaiming him to the world. Can we see the difference in the wording there? It is the assigned responsibility of this woman, God's ecclesia, God's called out ones, to bring forth this man-child to the rest of the world. Does that help us identify who that woman really is? That would be my assessment of this. Someone else mentioned to me that this woman is the bride of Christ. And I would agree with that. Someone who he regards very highly. And by the description, that would have to be our conclusion, that this woman is the highest in his assessment or in his appraisal of who she is and what she will become. Then we move into the second section. The second person or the second entity being revealed. And there appeared another wonder in heaven. And behold, a great red dragon. And I think we can quickly assume or identify who that is. A great red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. Now, we know from other prophecies, this would picture the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 2. And this would be placed, at least in that configuration of seven heads and ten horns, would be placed in the time frame of the prophesied end time. But it doesn't seem to be just that time frame. Seven heads and ten horns. Now let's reflect back to the previous one, the woman with 12 crowns upon her heads. If we identify that that is talking about the ecclesia in its full manifestation, that would be true throughout history. The Church of God throughout history is part of that picture. But the great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns, is that suggesting that that is the composition of the satanic world throughout time, where it's reflected in the world situation at the end time? We understand the seven heads to be the seven restorations of the Holy Roman Empire. We understand the ten toes, the ten kings, the ten heads, the ten crowns, being the very end time manifestation of the beast system. But is the satanic world patterned similarly throughout time? In other words, is the end time beast power, as we call it, a reflection of the makeup of the satanic world all along? Is it a reflection of him? Is that what this is telling us? Now, we don't have any problem identifying who the great red dragon is, but can we assign a time frame to this particular scene? Now, the other curious thing about it is, where it says, well, let's first move on to the third segment here, and that is, his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. Now, there is a spirit world that Satan has deceived and taken to himself, the demonic world as we understand it, that are in concert with him, that are his accomplices. But then it goes on to say, and the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her son, her child, as soon as it was born. Now think about the time frame of that. If this is talking about the birth of Jesus Christ, that's way out of the time context of what we're talking about here. How is that happening? He's standing ready to devour her child as soon as it was born. Now let's think back a little bit. In the first segment here, in the first few verses of the chapter, it talks about the woman bringing forth the man-child. Now, if it's true that that is an allusion to the church bringing Christ to the world, then we can better understand how the dragon could be there ready to devour her child as soon as it was born. You see here the picture? It isn't Christ's birth in the first century or before. It was actually the ongoing proclamation of Christ, the gospel, to the rest of the world. Satan has been continually poised to devour that message, to devour the people who present that message throughout history. And there's many examples that we could pose of that. For example, right at the very beginning, how did the, let's call it the Old Testament world, react to the birth of Jesus Christ? There were a few that were elated. But the vast majority, including the religious leadership, including the civil leadership, sought to kill him. As soon as he was born, they wanted to kill him. How did that happen? Who was doing that? And then a few years later, just a few years later, this was in about 42 AD. You see, Christianity had already been established in the British Isles. I spoke of that in the last message. The throne of David had been transferred to the British Isles back in the days of Jeremiah. They at least had an awareness of who they were, at least the elites of that society. The young Jesus spent years there, traveling with his great uncle, Joseph of Arimathea. I spoke of that last time. He, no doubt, introduced his teachings, his truth, to those people, and especially the royalty in southern England. And this is a fact of history. What we would call proto-Christianity developed in England in the first decades of the first century. Think about that. And that was followed up a few years later when Joseph of Arimathea, a disciple of Christ, was exiled from the Middle East, and he ended up in southern England. And he taught and he baptized even some of the royalty of the British nation. And Christianity began to flourish in England unhindered because it was outside of the Roman sphere of influence. So what happened? Did this phenomenon of Satan seeking her to devour her child as soon as it was born, did that play out in world history? There is a thing called the Claudian Edict. This was Emperor Claudius in Rome in 42 AD, just a few years after Joseph of Arimathea, maybe a decade or so after he ended up in southern England. The Claudian Edict included these instructions. It said, "Destroy Christian Britain." He knew what was happening religiously in Britain at the time. Destroy Christian Britain, man, woman, and child, and its great institutions. Guess what those were? They were institutions of learning. And to burn its libraries. That was a Roman technique. Whenever they wanted to conquer a people, they would burn their libraries so that they lost touch with their history. After a generation or two, no one would remember. But here's the big one. Kill any person descended from David. Who was David? Even secular Rome knew where the throne of David was in the first century. Here's an example of how that satanic intent, or that posing or posturing, ready to kill her child as soon as it began to take root and it began to flourish The secular world couldn't bear with it. They had to destroy. That was Satan inspired. And that, I think, is what we see here in Revelation 12. Ready to devour her child as soon as it was born. Well, not just then, because it happened throughout history. Christianity, in its purest form, in its most primitive form, flourished in southern England for 300 to 400 years before it was contaminated with the apostate religion that developed elsewhere. It was clear into the early or late 300s AD, early 400s, when Roman Christianity was so-called introduced to Britain. They take great credit for introducing these barbarians in England to the truth or to the Christian religion, when that's not the case at all. They came in by force of arms, eventually, and perverted it. So that the Christianity today is nothing like it was in the first century. Again, it's another function of this great red dragon's campaign to exterminate true Christianity. And it's happened throughout history. We could list many, many times. But that was just one early example. Now keep in mind, the book of Revelation wasn't written until a half a century after that event. So they didn't even have Revelation 12 at the time. But it was playing out from the time of Christ's actual birth to his ministry in his native land, to his ministry as it was conveyed into England. The pattern is there continually. Conquer and destroy the truth of God. That is Satan, poised and ready to devour her child as soon as it was born, wherever Christianity begins to take root and flourish. Satan's approach is, kill it. Either by apostasy, by infiltration, by military arms if need be. And that's the pattern all through history. We see it time and time again. Ready to devour her child as soon as it was born. We can think of our own personal history. Not that many years ago, where the truth was beginning to flourish, where it was being published to a degree that had never been in recent times. It was taken down. We had radio, we had publications, we had comparatively large numbers of people embracing the truth. What happened? What happened? Is it not a repetition of that very thing, that wherever the truth begins to flourish, Satan enters with the intent to devour her child as soon as it is brought forth. Something to think about. So that's that part of it. Now let's move on. There's a fourth segment here. And it talks about the assignment of the woman. It says, "And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne." Now let's consider that passage from the perspective of what is the time frame of that. Well, we know her child was caught up into his throne. We know when that was. But it says he's to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Well, that is his assignment. It's future, is it not? But it says she brought forth a man-child. Again, who is the she? It matters who the she is. If it's the church of God throughout history, this bringing forth is not in the sense of his physical birth, but it is the presentation of him to the rest of the world. The gospel message. The gospel about Christ, who he is, and what he is to do. And this passage sort of tells us that. This was our assignment as the church of God. This is what we're called upon to do. And then the fifth segment. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now we identify that as identifying a 1,260-year period of time. Again, think time frame. Is this talking about the 1,260 days in the time of the Great Tribulation? Or is there another application? Is this dual? Many of these things here are dual, both in their time setting and in their identifying what it's actually talking about. The 1,260 days, we say, is 1,260 years in one understanding. Well, the persecution of the church, its most intense persecution, with the beginning of what we could call Roman Christianity, was dominated and was subjugated and was basically driven from view by religious persecution of people who go by the same name. Christianity throughout the Middle Ages was not Christianity at all. It was merely a name for it, but it was different. Now that became most intense in about the middle 300s AD. And the translation of the Bible into English took place about 1,260 years later. The woman was, quote unquote, in the wilderness, or out of sight, or somewhat protected during that period of time. Is this referring to that as well? This isn't just talking about the 1,260 years at the end time, rather 1,260 days at the end time. It's 1,260 years as a period of history when the true church had to go into hiding. God protected her during that period of time. It was part of the plan. It was survival, put it plainly. The true church was sought out. Its people were jailed, in many cases killed. Now we'll see another duality as we get further down, but let's just go on to the next segment. And that begins in verse 6. All right, well, that's the one we just did. The woman fled into the wilderness, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. All right, go to verse 7. And there was war in heaven. And Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought against his angels. What does that refer to? There's a clue that we find in Daniel chapter 10. And it's a rare glimpse. But Daniel chapter 10. Verse 12. Now, Daniel had been praying for an answer to something. And verse 12 says, "Then said he unto me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten thyself before God, thy words were heard, and I am come for your words." I'm going to answer your questions. Verse 13, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia." There was a spiritual battle going on in the spirit world that we would not even recognize. And that tells you that there are battles going on in the spirit world. Now, we may see the reflection of that. But let's understand some of what's going on. It's occurring at the spirit level. And there's things going on in this world today that make us wonder, what is happening? How can this be happening? Well, let's understand there's a spirit component operating behind the scenes in many cases. This passage of Scripture sort of makes us aware of that situation. There was war in heaven, Michael and his angels. This is the same Michael we just read of. Fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought and his angels. There's a violent clash going on at the spirit level. "And prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven." This spirit body, let's say, this spirit world was cast out of heaven. When did that happen? Think time frame again. When did that happen? Well, Jesus himself said, "I saw Satan as lightning fall from heaven." That was before his time. That was before he was born into the flesh. He saw that. So there was an earlier occasion where that happened. But there was war in heaven. There's this great battle between the dragon and his angels and Michael and those that he is commanding. And it says, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan." So there's no question as to who the identity of this one is. "Which deceives the whole world." And that's a key phrase. We'll come back to that. "He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Now the seventh segment of this narrative begins in verse 10. "And I heard a loud voice saying from in heaven, Now is come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ." Come to whom? Is this talking about the beginning of the millennium? Or is this fit into a different time frame? Now is come salvation and strength. What is the strength? That's the power of God's Spirit. Does this cover a greater span of time? That's what I'm posing to you. Is it something, not only the end time, but is it the opportunity for those that God is calling to attain salvation? This is the day of salvation. It will culminate in the millennial kingdom when that opportunity will expand to a much greater number of called out people. But again, think time frame. When is this? The next phrase gives us a clue. "For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. So there's something else going on at the spirit level. We may not realize it, but think about the implications of that. The accuser of our brethren, which accused them before God day and night, makes you pause and think. How many things are we giving him to accuse us of before God and his throne? Did that tell us something? Watch what you're doing. Watch what you're thinking. Do we live by the light that was talked about in the first verses? Verse 11. Here's a hopeful retort to that. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. That was the answer to the accusations. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. There is a cleansing process. Continue. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. What is the word of their testimony doing? Is it not presenting the man-child to the world? Oh, and it continues. And they loved not their lives unto the death. Now, we know in the early centuries and perhaps throughout the Middle Ages, people were killed for their witness. They were killed for the truth. If someone were found in possession of the scripture, it could cost them their lives. There was an earlier day when martyrdom was common. But as we know from Revelation 6, the fifth seal, there's going to be another day where it says, and we should read that. Revelation 6 is something we need to be aware of because it's part of this same picture that we're talking about. Revelation 6. Verse 9, and when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, does you not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto them, every one of them. They didn't have those white robes before this time. And it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. We know from that there is to be an end time martyrdom of saints. This passage seems to be reflecting that. They loved not their lives unto death. God's truth, God's way, God's man-child is more important to these people than their own physical longevity. Next segment begins in verse 12. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe unto the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you having great wrath. Now think of the time frame of that one. Now we identify that as applying to the end time. Although it's been going on throughout history, I'm sure, this I think is more specific. This is the end time. Satan's wrath is going to be ramped up to a level like we have never seen. Because he knows that he has but a short time. That tells us that one of these other battles in heaven has been accomplished. There's more than one. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. I think we can understand what that's talking about. Again, that has happened throughout history, but I think it's also specific to our time. He vastly intensified his persecution upon the woman which brought forth the man-child. Now, the ninth section here, verse 14. It brings us to another question. And unto the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time, from the face of the serpent. Didn't we just read of that in the previous verse? Is there a second period of time, times and half a time, what we recognize as 3.5 years, as well as 1260 years, is this a second event where the church is protected for 3.5 years, literally? It sounds like there's a repeat event here. One typical, one that spans a long period of time, and another one that is very relatively brief, 3.5 years. That she might fly into the wilderness unto her place where she is nourished for time, times, and half a time from the face of the serpent. Now, all of this brings us to a conclusion. And this perhaps is the thing that we need to understand the most. And it's something that I think is encompassing of the entire time frame of the church from the first century to the present. It says in verse 15, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood." Now picture what happens in a flood. Things are just swept away. They're not there anymore. They're diluted. They're polluted. One thing about the flood, they say don't drink the water because you don't know what's in it anymore. It becomes polluted. Now this flood, in our literature, we have speculated or we have assigned as being the armies of Satan, and I would agree with that. But what is the material being carried by that flood? I think that's the thing we need to ask ourselves. What is that material? Wouldn't it be false information? A false worship system? A false Christianity? That's the best way to get rid of something sometimes, is simply inundate it with all kinds of pollutant. And this world's religions are polluted with about every false idea imaginable. People accept it as Christianity when it's no such thing. And that's not hard to figure out. When we understand the truth, we can recognize clearly that that's not God's word. That's not his religion. It's somebody else's. And it's infiltrated. It happened in Britain. After the 400s, the British people, by force, okay, when Augustine came there in the late 300s AD, representing the Roman religion, it was imposed. And many of the religious leaders refused it. And guess what? They were rounded up and killed. And thereafter, the religion in England was polluted with all kinds of apostate teachings, from Rome. It's a fact of history. But it says, and the earth opened her mouth. I mean, what pours out of someone's mouth? It's usually words, right? It's information. It's what you say. That's what's poured out of Satan's mouth. And the earth helped the woman. The earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. It wasn't opposed. It wasn't opposed. Not by the world in general. It was assimilated by the religious world of the day. Now there's that phrase that talks about the earth helped the woman. How did the earth help the woman? We know it swallowed the apostasy being poured out, but the earth helped the woman in another way. In the days of Constantine, he made Christianity the state religion. And that changed the whole persecution dynamic from that day forward. However, there was still that clash between true Christianity and false Christianity. So it never went away in that respect, but the earth helped the woman. In the early 1600s, the King James Bible, where the Bible began to be published in the language of the time. That was another way where the earth helped the woman. There was a nation that was founded, which provided religious freedom. The earth helped the woman in that respect too. We have a religious freedom, or did have, a religious freedom in this country like the world has never known, ever. Except possibly the first few centuries in England before Rome came in there. And we also have the agency of broadcasting. Another opportunity that was never afforded in the world. We can broadcast to millions of people simultaneously over the air. Something new. So the earth helped the woman, even though the world itself has swallowed the stuff that's poured out of the mouth of the dragon. Can we get the overall picture of what God is telling us here? Let's conclude with verse 17. And the dragon was wroth with the woman. Now think about the time frame of this one too. Is this after a second heavenly battle? And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Of all of these verses, I think this one is the most applicable to the modern time. It's talking about the remnant of her seed, the remains of those people who represent the person of Jesus Christ. Satan is deliberately making war with the remnant of her seed. Let's understand, this is going on at a spirit level, if not obviously in a physical level. Respect. But it's identifying and calling out the people who keep the commandments of God and have the true testimony of Jesus Christ. That's the whole picture of this entire chapter. The representation of Jesus Christ to the world by those people who have his testimony. So perhaps we'll never look at this passage of Scripture again with the same point of view. realizing that it covers a great span of time. It covers a multitude of different applications. There are many, many examples of these things happening. And I might mention something, and this is perhaps food for another message. I'll have to follow up with another one on this. I can see there's more material. As far as the physical application of these things that are described here. But all of the kings of Europe throughout the Middle Ages were under the control of the Roman religion. Kings could not be appointed, they could not be crowned without Rome's approval. However, that was not the case in Britain. The British could crown who they chose. Rome didn't have a say. They could marry who they chose. They didn't need papal approval. Now, that came to a head in the time of Henry VIII, but that's, again, like I say, another story. Just understand something. How it was important that Christianity in Britain was founded as it was. And it still had a distinction from the Roman form of religion that was later imposed on the rest of the world. And the rest of the world doesn't recognize the difference. They don't recognize the difference between true Christianity and apostate Christianity. Hopefully we do. But it's just something to realize that Revelation chapter 12 is a fascinating study, and I'm sure there's a lot more that could be said about it than I've said so far. God is giving us the basic outline. It explains why the world reacts to the truth as it does. Something to be aware of, but at least let's understand what our commission is, what our hope is, and what to expect as we carry out what God intends for us.